This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. And that is the song that made the man famous. Horace Silver, and song for my father. He was one of the greats of all time. Left us here the other day at 85 years old. As I said earlier, he wrote for Miles. He wrote some of Miles Davis's greatest hits and songs. He wrote for everybody. He was a brilliant jazz musician and writer and thinker and deep intellect and beautiful human being. Horace Silver left us at 85, so we played the brothers' songs during the course of this day. Remember, happy Juneteenth, everybody. Happy Juneteenth on this day. So here we are talking about the future of cycling in our city. We've done shows like this before. This is part of our series. I think we're going to call it Getting There, that we're doing on transportation in Baltimore. We're joined here by Milo Jackson. Milo Jackson is co-founder of Bearings Bike Project, co-organizer of the inaugural Red Bike and Green Ride on this today's Thursday.
Yes.
Today.
Yep.
Today. So we'll talk about that.
Right.
Dr. Kate Drabinski is with us. She seems to be in every show we're doing in the last couple of weeks. But here she is again, lecturer on gender and women's studies and director of the Women Involved in Learning and Leadership Will Program at UMBC. Writes the blog, What I Saw Riding My Bike Around Today. Good to see you once again.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Kate.
Good to be here.
Chris Merriam, who I've known for a long time, executive director of Bike More. 2012 OSI Baltimore Community Fellow, holds a master's degree in city and regional planning from Morgan State University. Good to see you, Chris.
Good to see you, too.
And Greg Cantore is with us, who I've also known for a very long time, president and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits and past president of One Less Car Bike Maryland, who rides his bicycle from Severna Park to Baltimore every day and back in this new kind of bicycle we'll talk a bit about because it looks like a little teeny car going down the highway. Good to have you all here.
It's great to be here.
Good to be here.
And if you're a bike rider and can hear the program today, please join us, even if you're not. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We want you to share your thoughts about the dangers and love and power of biking and what it means and what you think our city should and could be doing to promote and push biking as a way of life and transportation and movement in our town. 410-319-8888. So, where do we begin? There's so much here. Let me start with this whole question. Let me just start somewhere that I just want to get people to know that this is going on. Milo, it's good to have you in the studio.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I didn't know about this until Mark Gunnery brought it to my attention. So, what is this taking place? What is it? Red Bike and Green Ride.
Yeah, Red Bike and Green. Red Bike and Green is a collective that started in Oakland, California.
Yeah, I saw on Facebook it's a national thing. Right?
It is a national thing. There's chapters now in Atlanta, Chicago, New York, I think the beginnings in New Orleans, and we're trying to see what we can do to start, see what it looks like here in Baltimore.
What is it?
It's a collective of black urban cyclists improving the health, economy, and local environment of African Americans by creating relevant and sustainable black bike culture. Basically, you know, at the end of the day, we want to see more black people in the community on bikes riding together.
Let me start this way. I want to get a sense from you about biking because all of you are bikers, clearly. Mm-hmm. And just very briefly, just one or two things, the things you love about biking in this community, that you love about biking in Baltimore, and the things you think, very quickly, the things you think need to be improved, and we'll wrestle with those in greater depth. Kate, why don't we start with you?
Oh, I love bicycling, and I moved to Baltimore about 3 years ago, and the bicycle was my main form of transportation in New Orleans, where I lived before here.
Oh,
and biking is what has for me been a way to get to know the city, the streets, the neighborhoods. And the difference for me between biking and driving, which I used to do before my car died, is that driving, you're going through neighborhoods are really a conduit to get from where you live to the freeway. And when you're biking, the roads are just part of your world. And in order to bike safely, you need to pay really close attention to where you're going, what the street looks like, what the sidewalk looks like, who's around you, just to be safe. And what that means is that you're embedded in the community in a totally different way than when you're stuck inside of your own sort of metal box called a car. So for me, biking in Baltimore is it's just a wonderful way to learn the history of the place. Mm-hmm. It's taken me places like to do the Pennsylvania Avenue Black Heritage Walking Tour because I'm riding my bike out to UMBC and I just happen across it.
You ride your bike from here to UMBC?
Not all the time, but I do. Now I do a multimodal commute with a folding bike and the MARC train to sort of cut down some of the miles there. So I just love it as a way to get to know where I live and to get to know my neighbors. So that's what I love about it. What do I think biking culture in Baltimore needs. Well, it needs more bicyclists, because the more cyclists are on the road, the safer I feel and the more normal it is for cars and pedestrians, drivers and pedestrians, to know that I'm there.
Chris?
Well, I think on a personal basis, the reason I ride a bike is that it always makes me feel good. And anytime I'm having a bad day, or, you know, I'm bummed out about something, you know, all I have to do is get on my bike, and I'm like, oh, I don't feel like biking 3 miles, 5 miles. This is going to suck. And I get on my bike, and all of a sudden I feel better, and my heart rate goes up, and it's just perfect for me personally. And then on a broader level, I mean, we need to rebuild our communities to be more dense and with better transit and pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure. This is only a small part of a broader shift that we really need to do to combat climate change and a lot of other things. We need to provide alternatives to automobile-focused urban sprawl. And what I did at Morgan, I studied urban planning, got a master's degree there. And what I saw on the broader level was, you know, we really need to stop burning so much fossil fuel. And this is a really good way to do that on an individual basis. But if we're just asking individuals to make a lifestyle change, that's not going to cut it. You know, we really need to do better on building the infrastructure. It's shown all over the world that when you build the infrastructure, people will actually use it. And if you don't build the infrastructure, everybody will drive or, you know, wait for a bus all day, and that's the way it is.
Milo.
Very similar to what Kate was saying, and Chris, you know, the feeling of getting to know the city and riding around, and, I mean, every day that I'm on my bike, I feel like I see something that I, like, never saw before, and I'm like, oh, that's there, you know, and it's been there. And then also that feeling of, like, you've done something, you've exercised, like, your mind, your mental state by just getting out and getting on your bike. You know, you can be sitting around thinking you don't want to do anything, and then suddenly you're on the bike and you're like, I can do everything today. So, yeah, and I think that something that the city needs, yes, is more cyclists, more people on the road. The more cyclists that I see, like, the better it makes my ride every time I see and pass somebody on the road. Mm-hmm.
Greg Cantore.
And that's the transformation that I've been seeing over the years is the fact that there are more cyclists out there. We need to normalize the whole activity of cycling. So in the past, and even now, there's still a lot of Lycra cyclists out there. But normalizing means that we can wear...
You said Lycra cyclists?
Lycra cyclists. They wear a Lycra. But now we're seeing more and more people just wearing regular clothes out there. And it's a happy machine is what we're talking about here. It's a smile machine. We get on it. We smile. We feel happy. We're connected to the environment. We're connected to other people. We can relate to each other in different ways. We can smell. We can feel. It's an incredible sense. And the fact is that more of us that do this and more of us that even just try a little bit, when we become drivers again, the multimodal part, we then have a better understanding and appreciation mm-hmm. of the other cyclists. And this is the miracle that has occurred in Europe and in Amsterdam and Copenhagen, where almost 50% of trips are by bicycle now. It's that almost every driver is a cyclist. And because of that, the cyclists who are out there have a much better experience. So it's an amazing transformation. We're just starting to see here. I mean, I love hearing about this on Thursday. And the fact is that it has been sort of an elitist sport. It was my Lycra. And we're now normalizing it, making it so it's everybody.
I mean, I rode here today from Charles Village in a skirt and a T-shirt and some sneakers, and I've ridden in heels. I've ridden in almost anything you can imagine wearing. I've been on a bike in it. And what I love about the bike is how accessible it is. You can just hop on it and go. You don't actually need anything. Mm-hmm. Though I would say you need a helmet, but I don't want to get into that debate.
Well, that's a law, isn't it?
No.
It's not a law.
No.
Okay, good.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, I'm not. We'll quick into that a little bit if you want to. I mean, I have my feelings about laws that tell me what I have to do and not to do, but we can get into that in a minute. But I think that there's some important questions here about, you know, when I look at what's happening in Washington. I was listening to another radio station as I go back and forth from stations in my morning drive in my car down the highway to Morgan State University. And I go between our station here and hear some news on WAMU. And when I listened to a local news report on WAMU one morning, I was listening to this, how they now have these bike counters on every bridge to count the number of cyclists going across, and what they discovered is hundreds of more people are using bicycles, thousands perhaps using bicycles in D.C. and kind of changing the direction of how Washington views what they have to do to build a city that is more friendly to biking. Mm-hmm. Without the bike share program, which we can talk about in a minute, but I'm just talking about biking in general. That to me is it was really fascinating. We have just down the road a city not too dissimilar from ours in many ways, more expensive than ours. A mixed racial population, poor people, wealthy people, middle class people, all living in the same community, and it's become a huge biking community all around. So, what does that example say to you about us?
It tells me that cars are so 20th century.
Oh, they really are.
They really are. Their time has come and almost gone.
I'm not laughing at that.
I understand. The future is a city for people, and that's what we're seeing there. By seeing that increase there, the fact is that the future cities, the ones that are going to be successful, the ones that are built for people, accommodate them in every which way possible. And people want to locate, and there's been study after study showing this, that the cities that are attracting the young, educated people who want to relocate someplace have that kind of infrastructure in there and have a very open sense of open transit, multimodal on there so that you don't have to drive a car. And the study is also showing that young people are less and less likely to want to even drive. They're already moving away from that. And so these counters actually are also great, too. They're motivational because you're seeing, wow, 5,000 cyclists went past you last month. You know, so that maybe I'm not alone anymore.
No, I mean, I've had producers who are in the 30s and 20s, all of whom, some of them whom were just biked almost all the time, all the way, everywhere they went, to and from work, wherever they had to go. There was not like a... It wasn't like it was just a thing to do on weekends. It was the daily
part of life.
Yeah, I
make about 95% of my trips on bicycle. For me, it's about building a city for the people who already live here. Because, Chris, how many people in Baltimore don't have access to a car?
About a third.
About a third. So if we're going to build the city for the people who actually exist here right now, we are already riding bikes and waiting for buses. So that seems important.
One of the things I want to come back to my original question here, what does D.C. teach us? What does D.C. teach us, do you think, about what we have to think about where we have to go?
I'm going to pass that question.
Well, I think
it's flatter.
It's flatter.
That does make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, biking, whether someplace is a good biking city, there's a lot of things that go into that you can't control with public policy, but there are a lot of things that you can. And one of those things is building the infrastructure. You know, they have a bunch of really good bike lanes, including ones that are separated from car traffic, which really shows that's the Amsterdam model. That's the Copenhagen model. If you build a little lane that's right next to speeding traffic, but it's protected by a row of parked cars, those are the kind of infrastructure pieces that really get people out of their cars. And the other thing I would say for D.C. from talking to people who have lived there for a long time is that bike share was the real game changer there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a great biking city even with the infrastructure before bike share hit. And I think once people saw these like people that looked like them, you know, some and I'm talking about, you know, middle class people, you know, people on their way to work saw other people in suits or dresses riding these big clunky red bikes that really work great, and they're really nice bikes actually. Around the city, they're just like, man, I can do that too. You know, if he can do it, I can do it.
And what people don't see when we talk about people who are into cycling groups for the most part in Baltimore is that in the communities in our city, especially in poor communities, are mostly people of color and black folks who do not have cars. People cycle everywhere. You go to the west side of Baltimore, and people are on bicycles. People think it's all dirt bikes. No, it's bicycles. People are riding bikes because that's the form of transportation. That's the way to go. You can put your bike on the bus, on the light rail, to go up to Hunt Valley, get decent food, and then take the right back to your neighborhood and pedal back home. I mean, that's part of what we don't see in the city as well. And I think that, you know, one of the things that just to focus on, talking about the city, what it could be, I mean, let's take a look at what happened in New York City. Where the bike lanes are being built there are actually changing the entire way people move around New York City. It's kind of changing the nature of that whole place. It's made connections between metro shops and increased property values between stops. And could that happen here? I mean, what about the models there? We're talking about this is a busy New York City with lots of car traffic jamming the city, and they're trying to change the nature of that. And think about how that's happened there in Bogota, Colombia. You visit Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. Bicycles are everywhere. I mean, what can we learn from this? That's what I'm trying to get to. What can we learn from that about what we should be doing here in the city?
Political support.
It's leadership. It's simply leadership, because a lot of what they did in New York, which was really miraculous, was paint. A lot of it initially was just moving around bollards and paint, which is very low cost. And they did that in order to – and they called them pilot projects. So that way they could put it in place, see what happened, hear the screaming and yelling by the motorists, and then realize, hey, it wasn't so bad after all. And look, all these people are now using the new infrastructure that we put in place. But it took leadership to do that, because they needed to stand up to the criticism that was going to happen from the car drivers.
And the traffic engineers.
And the traffic engineers, right. And unfortunately, there's still a culture that everything has to be designed around cars here in Baltimore. And we know that because Chris and I attended a complete streets hearing, finding out why, with legislation that was passed in Baltimore City, 4 years ago, why not only has it not been implemented, but why is it that a lot of people don't even know what it is yet? And complete streets.
And the reality is that, you know, within the Department of Transportation, the traffic division that employs a lot of the traffic engineers of which we speak, and I don't mean to dump completely on traffic engineers, it's not all their fault, but they basically have a veto vote over a lot of projects. And when, you know, we can have the best bike planners in the world and they can push these plans through the pipeline and the planning process, and if one traffic engineer doesn't like it, they can just say, oh, that's going to hold up traffic too much. Nope.
We're going to have a very short break, and we're going to come right back to continue this conversation, 410-319-8888, as we look at biking, the first of our serious conversations about where biking could take this city, how we could change the nature of our transportation, what do we need to do to change consciousness, change the design, and more. 410-319-8888, we're going out with Horace Silver's Senor Blues. Nutville. Is that where we live? That's what Horace Silver says. That's his great song, Nutville. Fits this place sometimes. We are here reminding you that. Not necessarily the stage. I'm talking about the whole community in the world. Anyhow, we'll remind you that the first Baltimore Red Bike and Green Ride is happening tonight. It's a bike ride for African-American bike riders. Meet at 7:30 in the parking lot behind the school at Lake Montebello. The ride starts at 8 p.m. and ends at 9 at the Grindhouse Juice Bar in 2441 St. Paul Street. Grindhouse. They make some – I love the Grindhouse.
Yeah, it's a good spot.
It's a good spot. So you can join us here now, 410-319-8888, as we look at the future of bike riding, where we with the state of it now in Baltimore, what can make it better. Milo Jackson is co-founder, co-organizer of the inaugural Red Bike and Green Ride tonight here on Thursday. Milo Jackson is also co-founder of the Bearing Bikes Project. Chris Merriam is Executive Director of Bike More, 2012 OSI Baltimore Community Fellow, holds a Master's Degree in City and Regional Planning from our university here, Morgan State University. Greg Cantori is President and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits and past President of One Less Car Bike Maryland. And Dr. Kate Drabinski is a lecturer of Gender and Women's Studies and Director of the Women Involved in Learning Leadership Program at UMBC, and writes the blog, What I Saw Riding My Bike Around Today, 410-319-8888. So before I get into some other kind of political issues here, there's some of the issues that are facing bike riders that have come up in the news a lot lately, which has been the physical attacks on bike riders in Baltimore. What's your sense? Just curious what you think. Mind let me start and then go to Chris and Kate. I mean, you all have been ride the city a lot. So what are your thoughts?
I never experienced anything like that until I moved to Baltimore, actually. Within my first couple of weeks, I had a group of children actually chase me down on my bike, and I was really confused. At first, I thought they wanted to hang out. they were just trying to flag me down. That wasn't the case. I think that the safety of riding in numbers is always good, you know, which I think goes back to getting more people on bikes. But, I mean, I feel like you should also be able to ride at night and not worry about such things. I've been seeing these attacks happen, and I'm not really sure what exactly I'm not really sure what we can do to really prevent that or what we can do about that. I don't know if it's better lighting on streets or, you know, just more visibility. Yeah.
Kate?
Yeah, you know, I haven't I haven't actually personally experienced this, but I see a lot of reports of this on the internet, so I believe that it's happening. I don't know why. I think that's really complicated. One thing I will say is that bad things happen to you when you're in a car, when you're walking, biking. Bad things can happen to you there too.
That's important, right?
And I think
we perspective.
Yeah, just a little perspective, just because we tend to. One thing I've noticed is that people think when they find out I ride a bike everywhere, the response is often, "Wow, you're amazing," and I'm actually not amazing at all. I just happen to not have a car. This idea that biking is really unsafe, that you're going to fall, you're going to get hit by a car, you're going to get attacked by children, because it's children doing this, as far as I can tell, like tweenagers. And it's actually, I've ridden thousands and thousands and thousands of city miles without any of those things happening. I'll just say that.
That perspective is important, really important in all this. Chris?
And I want to just put that out there, that it's not just people on bikes. I mean, people have been attacked while walking as well. And, you know, this is Baltimore, and sometimes bad things happen. But I would also echo what Kate said about, you know, bad things happen sometimes in Baltimore in general. And
Chris, do you have a sense of how pervasive these attacks have been? I mean, like, I know my friend Adam has been attacked multiple times recently, but what is the, do you have any sense at Bikemore how often this is happening?
It's hard to tell because a lot of those incidents aren't reported.
Mm-hmm.
And the police sometimes don't want to give you those stats.
Okay.
But we field at least four or five complaints about that per cycling season, I would say. But I'd also like to say that, you know, we know that these incidents don't represent the actions of all Baltimore City youth. And we know that, you know, the vast majority of city youth are doing positive things and not harming other people. And we don't want to make this a, you know, let's go lock them up and throw away the key thing. We know that's not a productive response to it. I personally think, and this is something we've been working on with the Greenmount West community, is to, and other communities as well, is try to engage kids in bicycling, you know, work with them to get their own bikes and make them part of the culture, you know, because I think that ultimately this is a response based on, you know, disadvantaged, poverty, lack of supervision. It's stuff that we really shouldn't be like blaming these kids for. I mean, the action, you should be held responsible for your actions, but it comes from a deeper place that I think we need to meet with more compassion than anger. And it's a very difficult topic, you know, because we want to tell people, hey, go ride a bike, it's safe. And then stuff like this happens, and then fear takes over, you know.
Yeah, for me, it's been I've had 125,000 miles now of bicycling mostly through the city, and over 30 years, and never had an episode of being attacked on there. Well, I do have problems and have had problems with, of course, of motorists having beer thrown at me, which is an interesting thing when you think about it, beer in the car. An open bottle of beer being thrown at you. And
you're the one doing something wrong,
I'm doing something wrong, right. And in fact, I came home one day and Renee, my wife, said, you've been drinking? Because I smelled the beer. But actually, there's this group of kids in Brooklyn, Curtis Bay, that I see going home on a very frequent basis, especially in the summertime because they have more free time. There's about 20 or 30 of them on bicycles. And I love it because I'm coming up the hill on Patapsco Avenue. And they're waiting there. They're riding around doing wheelies and things like that. And they see me, and it's like instant race. Mm-hmm. And it's so much fun. So for about four or five blocks, we're just tearing down the street. They're trying to chase me down. And that's a very positive.
I think, and what you're saying here is important, Greg, because I think this is more the case than the other.
That's right.
And what we do is we sensationalize the violence in our urban communities and say, oh, you can't ride your bicycle because you're going to get jumped and beat up. It does happen. But, you know, you can get confronted in your car. You can get confronted walking down the street. All kinds of things happen in communities, period. I mean, that's just the nature of what happens. And also because of the dislocation and the deindustrialization and poverty and people being angry about all kinds of stuff. And that stuff erupts.
Yeah.
So the majority of bikers do not get jumped.
No. And one thing that writing a regular blog has done for me is helped me sort of focus every day on what it is I'm seeing when I'm out riding my bike around. And what I've seen is that neighborhoods don't get to be neighborhoods by accident. They're the result of concerted choices by planners, by real estate agents, by things like that. And I've sort of and by the decision to run a freeway through a neighborhood, for example. And I do think that biking has helped me become attuned to that and realize that we could make different choices, you know, and we could. Cars are only normal now. I mean, when you're biking, how many times have you all sort of like bumped over some streetcar tracks that are emerging from the broken roads? Like mm-hmm. you can see we used to have other modes of transit. And
yes,
we could did. Actually make things mm-hmm. make – like cars don't have to be normal. And so
right.
so we
right.
need – if we normalize biking yeah. – and I feel like yeah. the sort of, oh, you're going to get jumped, you're going to die from a car or something, that stuff is – keeps us from ever imagining bicycling as a normal activity.
Beginning with the end in mind is that when the Sun paper was doing the article on the Velomobile, I said that I hope for Bike to Work Day, I hope someday we'll have a drive your car to work day.
Yeah.
drive as a novelty.
Yeah. There's our future, right?
I mean, I'm one of those around who grew up here old enough to remember the trolley system. And Wally Olinsky, once president of city council, his idea before they built what we used to call the Rouse train, the subway that went from Baltimore out to the county that was stopped at every mall owned by the Rouse Company, was that right. they put money back into rebuilding the streetcars of Baltimore City and have them become the major mode of transportation mm-hmm. in our community and build things around it, which made a great deal of sense. And I'm mm-hmm. thinking about public transportation with bikes. And, you know, when you look at the buses going up and down, you see two bike racks on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that enough? I mean, how do you change how we use our public transportation system with our bicycles? And the idea of having a bike share that Jimmy Rouse talks about in the show as part of his whole campaign to kind of pull people together to rethink our transportation in the city is to have a bike share at every transit stop, mm-hmm. every metro stop, every subway stop, and that's how you start building it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do we think about all that, how that affects our biking?
Well, I think that's another thing that D.C. does really well. It's another reason that D.C. has a really good bike mode share is that they have a great transit system also, and that the two have a lot of interplay between them. You know, you can take your bike on the subway if you're too tired in the afternoon, or, you know, if you need to wear a suit that day or whatever reason you have for not wanting to ride a bike in a certain part of your trip, you can put it on the subway. You can put it on the front of a bus. And what we're, you know, really trying to do is to make a sustainable transportation system with choices for people. So it's not just about riding a bike. It's not just about any one of these things. It's about the interplay between all of them.
Maryland nonprofits were on a very important mission right now of looking at all our nonprofits, looking at the quality of life and how all of us are working towards improving the quality of life of our neighborhoods, our communities, ourselves, our families. And what we're talking about here, the multimodal with choices of being able to ride and walk safely, take a mass transit, and having that there really does improve quality of life. So any of us have had the opportunity to go to Europe and spend some time in Copenhagen and Amsterdam. I hear this all the time. Boy, it'd be so nice to have that here. It just seems so much more relaxed. I could just jump on the train. I could jump on my bicycle. I could walk anywhere. I didn't have to drive. There was no sense of having to do that. There's something about this, too, is that we think that cars are faster. And I want to just put this out there because I know, Mark, your audience is very, very intelligent. They really are. And they think about stuff like this. There's something called effective speed, and effective speed, you know, speed is distance divided by time, it's miles per hour and so on. But we don't count the hours as the time that it takes to earn that modality.
What does that mean?
Well, if you have a car that costs, let's say, $12,000. Cheap car, right? $12,000. You have to earn that $12,000 in order to drive that car. In the meantime, someone who's riding a $100 bicycle is already on the road and is no longer has to earn that spend that time at the desk to earn that modality. So effective speed is the speed that you go minus the total time it takes to earn that modality. And so walking, of course, is very cheap. Bicycling is very cheap. And then mass transit is right up there as well. And so when we look at effective speeds, and there's a study by a fellow named Tranter in Australia who's documented all this, the effective speed of most cars is somewhere between 12 and 13 miles an hour. The effective speed of a bicycle is around 12 or 13 miles an hour.
I watched the other day. So I was driving from driving my car down Maryland Avenue, Cathedral Street, and noticed some people on their bikes. But I noticed particularly there's one woman on the bike who's to my right and just watching her ride, and realized that she was – I passed her at some point. And then
right.
I passed her – I guess it was up – passed her over by where the City Cafe is on Eager Street. And then by the time I got down to Franklin right by the library, she was there a block ahead of me. At the other end of the library. I mean, I watched kind of how bikes roll and can actually maneuver and move. But I also watched about how dangerous it was, because the room she had and the other bikers had between the two or three lanes of traffic and the cars parked on your right or left gave very little room for her or anyone else to maneuver. That's something that has to be attacked.
But that's what we call the door zone. And the one crash I've ever been in, in my 5-something years of biking in the city, was a door zone crash in which I was riding too close to parked cars, and a guy opened his door, and I went flying over the door, and you know, hurt myself up pretty bad. I think it should be mentioned that, you know, and I think there's probably a lot of people out there being like, all right, well, yeah, the reason that the woman beat you down Cathedral Street is because she was jumping red lights, you know. And frankly, that's something that needs to be handled within the bike community. I mean, there needs to be more following the rules. The other thing is that, you know, I tend to tell people not to pass cars on their right, which is just a really bad maneuver. Puts you in the door zone, puts you in a place where people are not expecting to see you. So there's, you know, there's some, you know, a bike, it really is almost as fast as a car for a lot of trips under 3 miles, but there's also some pretty dangerous techniques being used out there. So.
Well, my producer, Mark Henry, just well, he's been doored twice in the city and both times in the throat and got flipped over by drivers when they opened their door.
Right.
But the issue is, what I'm curious about is when we talk to our politicians, we talk to our planners, when we talk to those who have the power to really change those things and alter everything, do things in the city. How do we change that? I mean, how would we redesign Maryland Avenue? How do we redesign Guilford Avenue from north to south, or Greenmount Avenue, York Road from north to south? Or North Avenue east to west? How do we begin to redesign those streets?
Well, we're redesigning Maryland Avenue.
We are,
Chris,
actually.
Tell us about it. I'm so excited.
So there's actually a project that's going to be starting in the fall, which is we're calling the Maryland Avenue Cycle Track. And what it is a protected bike lane. They're moving the row of parked cars out one space and then creating the two-way bike lane between the curb and the new where the parked cars are. So it's a fully protected bike lane. It's going to go from 29th Street all the way down to Pratt Street, and it's 2.6 miles of fully protected infrastructure. So that's a street that's actually going to be seeing a really big change in the next year or so. What you need to do. You need to sometimes remove lanes of traffic.
It seems to me that every time we think about how to resurface a road in Baltimore City or change the way we do things, how do you make that part of the conversation that you create bike lanes, not like ones that they go for like 3 or 4 blocks and then disappear, but actually, you know.
Hey, Light Street. Yeah.
But you actually kind of create this world that gives more room.
That's the complete streets.
Yeah,
that's
exactly we already have that is. Plan.
Yeah, that's the plan that's in place. It's not always being implemented, except for things like Maryland Avenue, which was great to hear. But that's exactly what it means. It means looking at the reason it's called complete is looking at the complete set of users, not just cars, and how do we accommodate the pedestrians and the people on bicycles and people waiting for the bus, you know, there's an organization called 880, and I love the name because it has a mission that. All cities should be designed for 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can accommodate your 8-year-olds and your 80-year-olds,
then we're safe.
We're good.
Yep.
We're then good.
I like that.
Yeah.
880.
Isn't that great?
So whatever happened to the bike trail starting and the Hiron Jones Falls going through Lincoln Park and coming down to the downtown Baltimore, did that ever end? Was it ever completed?
Well, I think you're talking about two different things. The Gwynns Falls Trail and the Middle Branch Trail, that goes
They're
from Lincoln Park
areas.
Down. And then Jones Falls Trail is almost done. There's a section that's going up to Mount Washington that's going to be done within the next year, I would say. But the lower part of that is almost done. It's basically done.
And Milo, how would you like to see things change here?
The complete roads, that would be, I mean, being able to get from at least a point A to a point B instead of that ride where you're like, okay, well, that was nice for a second. I didn't really get anywhere. I'm at, you know, a corner of a street now. I would like to see that because biking in other places, you know, like I've biked in Portland and I've biked in Chicago. And, you know, I felt like I was able to get from one place to the next. And I would really like to see that happen here.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think people need to feel empowered to go out and ride on the streets that we already have. And I don't know what, if you know me in real life, you know that I'm not some like brave daredevil. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't eat something that's been in the fridge for more than 2 days. I'm like, I'm a scaredy cat about a lot of things. But for something switched in me, and sometimes when I'm riding on the street with cars, and I know cars are frustrated because I'm slow. But then I remember things like they have to slow down and go around the UPS truck. Mm-hmm. The UPS truck doesn't freak out and think it has to jump on the sidewalk, you know, and sometimes I'll actually say out loud to myself, you belong here too. You know, the kind of like stuff I teach my feminist students in our classes at UMBC, you know, right. You belong here too. Take the street. It's fine. They can wait. And just that kind of the sort of feeling like you're entitled to the space as well and just getting out there. And one thing I like to do is take new cyclists. And like, okay, well, why don't you just follow behind me while I go somewhere and I'll show you how to do this? Because I think for some people, it's just, I don't know, what will I do if I find myself on Charles Street? Mm-hmm. You know, it's really scary when you first start, but learning with other cyclists and just sort of jumping into it and just seeing how to do it, I think is important.
I mean, there are a lot of drivers who have no respect for bikes and don't even think they should be on the road and get very angry when bikes are on the road.
Yeah. I mean,
that's part of the reality
Well. And the problem is that a lot of those people are politicians and are decision makers. And, you know, when you look at the people who are making these decisions about how our roads are maintained and built, you know, it's people who don't walk to work, they don't ride a bike. You know, they haven't ridden a bike since they were 7 years old. They'll tell you that, you know. And sometimes you'll hear this from people who should know better, you know, that, you know, bikes shouldn't even be on the road, you know. So when you're trying to make the argument that we need livable streets for people, not just automobiles, mm-hmm. but you're talking to people who are dominantly using a car for their mode of transportation. So their perspective is limited sometimes.
What do we know about what happened to our bike share program? I know that it was the contract was pulled. Company was going belly up. Mm-hmm. Now it's going to wait to 2015.
Right.
Did it have to wait to 2015? Or there something we're missing here? What's the status? Anybody?
I have no idea.
The latest I've heard is that it really is it's not really the city's fault. And believe me, I would say it if it were. But it's largely the fault of external forces. But this is another thing where the city really needs to invest in, a bike share planner who really knows the business and has done this in another city. It's a very specific skill set that you need for that position. And, you know, the folks that have been working on it for the past several months have been doing the best they can, but that's not what they were hired for. Mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of thrown into their lap. And, you know, I think the mayor really needs to make a strong statement of hiring somebody who can really run that program and get the local sponsorships and do the corporate kind of handshake deals and that kind of thing. I mean, that's a really important skill to have. So, you know, but as the technology works itself out, I think the challenge is going to be more on our end is like who do we hire to run that program? So we need to find the right person.
So how often do the four of you ride your bikes as a way of existence, as opposed to being in a car?
I no longer own a car. I've always thought of a car as a really big purse full of trash that you have to put somewhere. You got to drag around with you and put somewhere. I hate parking. And then my transmission gave out in December, and they said it would be $2,500 to replace it. And I realized that first, A, I didn't have $2,500, but second, I could get like 10 bikes for, you know, 20. So I bike. I have access to a car if it's an emergency, and I join Zipcar, so I have that
Zipcar, which was a really important thing.
It's an emergency so again, the multimodal commute, like connecting your trips, and I got a folding bicycle, so I can take that on the MART train, and so I would say 95% of my 98% of my trips are by bike.
Milo,
I would say about 80%. I also have a vehicle. I tend to be – I have a big vehicle, so I tend to transport bikes and dogs a lot. yeah, I would say probably about 80% of my traveling around town is on a bicycle.
Yeah. I mean, I would say 60%, and a lot of it is walking, actually, because I work in very close proximity to my house, so I do a lot of walking. And but 60% on bike, and I take transit sometimes, take cabs, Zipcar. You know, I have the whole range of multimodal options in front of me, and, you know, given whatever trip I need to take, I'll take the best one for that. But it's, you know, a majority is bike trips, yeah.
And you guys all got me beat, so probably around 40 or 50% of the time, because I have a lot of suit and tie appointments and long-distance travel across the state.
You've been doing it for 30 years.
But I've been doing it for 30 years, so that's it, 120,000 miles. But one thing I'm proud of is that my bikes cost more than my car.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Same.
And you do ride most days between your home and Severna Park and Baltimore
City. As many days as I possibly can. Yeah, 25 miles each way.
And that's, you've logged how many miles doing that, did you say?
It's about 120,000 now. Wow. And my doctor said that the engine just needs a tune-up.
Uh-huh. All engines begin to need a tune-up.
And can I just say that once you get out there and ride, it can become normal for you too. I never imagined I would be a bike commuter, and you're so freeing, and it's so fun, and it's wonderful. It's like you get to be a kid every day.
Well, I appreciate you all being here, and let me start with very quickly, Milo Jackson, talk about tonight again, where people can go.
Tonight, you can meet us at 7:30, the playground, Lake Montebello. We'll be riding from there to Grindhouse on St. Paul.
Red bike and green bike ride tonight, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And Dr. Kate Drabinski, always great to have you here.
Thank you. Check out my blog, what I saw riding my bike around today.com.
That's it. Chris Merriam, executive director of BikeMore.
BikeMore.net. Thank you.
There you go. And Greg Cantori. Good to have you.
It's really great to be here.
Good to have you all here. So we'll have you all back. And we're going to continue this conversation about what we do to make this a more livable, healthy city. And we didn't get into one of the subjects we talked about a lot in years past was a ciclovia, which started with great fanfare and petered out. And we need to bring back ciclovia.
Bring it back.
Bring that back.
And the city fair in Baltimore will be amazing.
Yeah, New York has a nice ciclovia summer streets every summer. So we can do it.
So when we come back, we'll start off with ciclovia and why we can't have ciclovia back in Baltimore. It started under Sheila Dixon, I think, when she was mayor, and then kind of petered out. So we have to get this back alive again. And we're going to go out here with Horace Silver and Tokyo Blues. Great Horace Silver. And we come back, take a break, thank our guests for being here, and talk to another one of our candidates running for governor, Larry Hogan and Boyd Rutherford, here to join us as they seek the Republican nomination for governor of the state of Maryland. Stay with us.